Okay, we can resume.
Okay, so yes, I was wounded. Shrapnel.
More than once?
Arms and legs. Yeah, but it was so close together that it, in time, that it was, I never looked for the second. Actually, I never reported the first until it started to bother me.
Okay.
And it was when Carrie got the Silver Star.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. It was first week in the river. Third day in the river, fourth day in the river. And when the B-40 went off at the edge of the water, I got sprayed with some shrapnel. I got some in the leg, got some in the arms. And, you know, I was a rookie, so the pieces that were sticking out, I kind of pulled out.
Yeah.
But a couple of months later, there was some that was bothering me that was under the skin. And Corman was riding along with us. And I told him about it. And he extracted some more.
Okay.
But I had taken the bigger chunks out, so I hadn't reported it. So when the corpsman took some out, then there was a report done on it. But
so you were lucky again in that you through all this you weren't seriously injured.
Yeah, very lucky.
Yeah, that's.
I had been hit. I had taken a glancing round off the helmet one time. I took a glancing round off. Had a pocket in the flak vest, and I had a couple of clips of M16 ammo in it, and I a glancing round hit that, you know, and
wow.
So I was pretty lucky.
Yeah. So lucky. You got a Purple Heart for that, I assume,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the whole Purple Heart thing, I never, you know, most of us were unaware of the controversies about Purple Hearts until the 04 presidential election and Kerry and all that stuff. Was there active lobbying by servicemen to be awarded the Purple Hearts? Was there abuse to this process?
I had never heard anyone lobby. I didn't know anybody who was dying to collect a Purple Heart. It means you're going to get hurt. Why would you want one?
Right.
So
that makes sense.
I didn't hear any lobbying for Purple Hearts. I didn't hear anybody say, gee, I really want a Purple Heart.
Okay.
Because they got to be nuts.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Because that was one of the allegations against Kerry in that election.
Yeah.
And we could talk more about that when we get to that. But I wondered about that. Did your feelings about the war change at all while you served?
Well, you know, while you're involved in it, you're certainly going to become more. You want to become rah-rah. This is a team event,
right.
You know?
Right.
And you. If you're up and, you know, rah-rah, you're going to be more, you're not going to be backing off and
right.
being worried about getting hurt and stuff. You've got to be aggressive.
Right.
Or you're going to not survive.
Right.
And not only are you not going to survive, what about the guys that are on your crew? You want them to survive. You want them to come home unhurt. So, yeah, you get really rah-rah about it. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to take a step. If you're worried, if you're concerned, if you're worried about getting hurt, you might become a half a step slower.
Right.
And that could cost somebody their life.
Right.
And you don't want to be that. So,
well, you had mentioned,
so I got stronger into, you know, I became very conservative.
Yeah.
And when I got home, I was still very conservative. And then you make a swing and become more liberal. And then I got back to the middle of the road after about a year, and that's where my comfort zone is.
Okay.
So,
well, I just wondered, you had said before you went away that your only real comment about the war had been that you thought that the South Vietnamese were fighting for what we already had.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you still, well, during your time there, if you still thought it was a righteous cause or if you just didn't really think about it.
Did
you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
So, of course, you were aware of the anti-war movement back home. You know, how did you feel about that when you were serving?
You weren't that exposed to it. You knew what was going on when you went over.
Right.
But you weren't seeing it because we didn't have, I wasn't watching TV. I wasn't listening to the radio. I didn't know Woodstock was going on.
Ah, okay. You know? Yeah.
I mean, that's...
You were in isolation, pretty much.
Yeah. You heard about big news events.
Right.
Like... let's see. Probably one of the real strange ones for me was July, well, 20th of July, we find out that there's actually men on the moon. There's men on the moon, and a week before, we had run into punji stakes at low tide. We saw where we were beaching the boats coming ashore, low tide, punji stakes are sticking out of the riverbank where they would have been covered at high tide. These are sticks sharpened so that when you're jumping off the boats, they would pierce you.
Wow.
They are dipped in feces so that not only will you be wounded, you will be infected. How can we be facing something that primitive? And there's guys on the moon. I went up on the upper deck of the barrack ship and just stared at the moon for about a half an hour. How can this be?
That's interesting.
If we can do that, what are we doing facing this?
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah.
It was just weird. That was one thing that I'll never forget.
That's an interesting piece of color. That's a real flash. Because there's a real juxtaposition, right?
Yeah.
Between, you know,
it's
the modern and the primitive. Did you know anybody personally who was anti-war, either there or at home? Or?
Not really.
No?
No.
Okay. Another thing that comes up a lot is allegations of atrocities. Did you encounter any of that from either side when you were there that you were aware of?
No.
Or no.
We were
on the boat.
That's one of the things that really bothered me with the testimony and all that stuff, because we were very careful. We knew where villages were. We would not fire near them. We knew where, if an area where the woodcutters were working, one of the nice VC tricks was to fire at us from that area to try to draw fire into the civilians.
Yeah.
And we would not return fire in that instance. We were as careful as possible about the civilians.
Okay.
One of the things that bothered me is you see little kids that have been damaged, you know, that might have scars on their legs or whatever and stuff. It bothered me that kids had to grow up in that environment.
Yeah.
Even though Vietnam had been at war for years, why would a kid not be able to grow up in a safe environment? That always bothered me when I was there.
Yeah.
The civilians, as far south as we were, they didn't have a lot of contact with the government. They just wanted to survive. Their livelihood was fishing, cutting wood, things like that. And we're in there telling them they can't operate on the rivers at night. Well, they've got to get their goods to market, and that's their highway system. And they have to leave before dawn to get to a market to sell goods. And you know, it was just tough in instances like that to justify not letting them do it.
Right. That's fair. I think I already know kind of the answer to some of the next question, but I was going to ask you if you formed any really strong friendships with people that you served with, and if that those friendships extended beyond the war.
Yeah, one of the things about Vietnam was you didn't really go over as a unit. All of Coastal Division 11 didn't go over together.
Yeah.
You had a one-year tour. I went over with four crews. Some of them stayed, you know. So the guys I was going to be friendly with, I might know some of them only 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
Some of them I might know a whole, you know, the entire year. But I told you one friend, my best friend, I went through training with and served with in the same division. We've remained friends. He lives in Ohio, and I'm friends with him. A lot of the contacts and friendships I reinvigorated were due to Kerry's run for president. And pretty much most of them were on the anti side.
Yeah.
But that's how I found them.
Right.
You know, that's here there's a newspaper article. Geez, he lives in New Hampshire.
Yeah, he's close,
you know.
Yeah.
And same with Peter Upton in his law office is in New Britain, but he's living in Hartford. He was in Unionville. But I saw him in the documentary, and I have a picture of Don Droz and myself and Peter Upton at the ambush site from February 28th when Kerry got the Silver Star. And I thought he was dead, that guy. And so I contacted him at his law office in New Britain, and we got together again, struck up a good friendship. Fellow up in New Hampshire, is a good friend. He's up in the Lake Sunapee area. I wouldn't have found him if it wasn't for Kerry running for president. Another Naval Academy grad is in Washington State. We stay in contact now. So a lot of it was interesting, you know, the whole thing. If you want to get into that right now, or wait till
the Kerry thing?
Later.
Whatever you want to talk about. Like I said, we don't have to go in order.
Well, we can, because it feeds into after coming out of the country. So maybe that's the appropriate place for
it. Well, actually, the next thing on the list was Kerry, but you mentioned the Silver Star incident and what have you. It might be a good time to kind of talk about your experience knowing him.
When we were assigned to his boat in our first, our indoctrination in the rivers, and really what they're trying to do, I think, is find out if you can hack it and survive it mentally.
Yeah.
I think it was the 25th of February, 24th or 25th, we transited down south on Kerry's boat. Three boats were going to operate together, PCF 23, which was skippered by a fellow named Bill Rude, and Bill ended up being an editor of the Chicago newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times. What's the Chicago? Tribune.
Oh, Tribune, okay.
Yeah. And the other was a 43 boat with Don Droz, which was destroyed on April 12th. We operated off of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Spencer off of Square Bay down south. So we were operating the Coulon and the Bihop. And first day in the river, we were taking UDT team in. We were going to do a search and destroy mission of a known complex of bunkers and stuff like that. We were going to destroy them if we could, or else put CS gas in them, which makes them it's like tear gas, make them inoperable for a long time if we couldn't destroy them. So we went in. We went into the Coulon. John Kerry used to like to shoot up the banks a little bit to trigger an ambush ahead. So if we were in an area that we knew didn't have villages, he'd kind of pre-prep the banks of the river. He was the OTC, the Officer in Tactical Command. He was in charge of the boats of the operation. We had helicopters when we needed them. We had UDT aboard.
Were you and he of the same rank, or did he have?
Yeah,
ranking?
We were both JGs.
Yeah. Okay.
But he had been in country longer than Usually, the OTC would be the person that's been in the rivers the longest, for obvious reasons. You know it the best.
Yeah.
So we went through the end of the rivers, and we were short of the Bow D, and we were ambushed. I'm in the starboard door. He's in the port side door of the cabin of the pilot house. So you can bark your orders to the helmsman. Your gun tub is above you, so you can get orders to the guns. And a recoilless rifle round went off, missed us, and the AK-47 started chattering. I immediately emptied two rounds of M16 ammunition into the wrong side of the riverbank. Knew what I was doing.
Well, you were new.
Yeah, I was new. And we ended up suppressing the fire. It didn't last long, maybe about 10, 12 minutes. And then we went in afterwards and swept that area. They blew up some bunkers. And then they set CS gas and the others. They used C4 to blow the bunkers they could blow up. And the ones that were well fortified, they put CS gas in, and we, you know, as we left, we would trigger the gas. And that tear gas effect would be in there for months. So we're getting ready to beat feet, and Chopper had seen somebody enter a bunker on the other side of the river. So we went over and we swept that area, and there was a bunker. We were trying to hollering in there. Nobody was coming out. So we just tossed a grenade in and got back to the boats, and we were headed north towards the Bodie. Well, with the way that river was situated, we were actually headed east. And they blew the CS in the bunkers. Well, the way the wind was blowing was the way we were going. So we CS'd ourselves. We're dealing with the old tears and the, you know, and it was just hilarious. Here we are. We're the ones that the tear gas is affecting.
Wow. So interesting.
Yeah, it was. So that was the first day on the river.
So what'd you think of him at the time, I mean, and the way he conducted himself?
During that week, he was the OTC on all of the missions. And I wrote an op-ed in the Springfield newspaper concerning his service. I didn't take any sides politically. But I felt that when I was on his boat in that week, he had done a good job. He was a good officer. He was aggressive. He was getting the job done, and he was he didn't seem to be putting his crew in danger. So I was impressed, because the three boats operated very well together. They knew each other, it was a very fruitful week. We seven days on the river, and you know, one night patrol. And we had been through 10 firefights, and I thought he handled himself well, and that's what I wrote in that op-ed.
Fair enough.
A month later, excuse me, a month later, mid-March, was the controversial Bronze Star bit, where he claimed his boat had been mined, but the one that got blown out of the water was my friend's. And nobody remembers taking any fire from the shore on that. It was pretty much strictly a one mine incident. And Kerry claimed the other boats left, but he stayed there. He was the one that bugged out. And took off down the river. The other one stuck around and went over and took over the three boat, which was mined.
Yeah.
And blown out of the water. Got it operating. It was, so I think somewhere along the line, John knew what he wanted to be. You know, he wanted to be in politics.
Yeah.
And I think he was pretty much getting his ticket stamped. He was doing well. And I think he was starting to look at his own mortality.
Mortality, yeah.
And I think it probably had something to do with, you know, what was going on. But he did have a tendency to take some other incidents that maybe he wasn't involved in, but said he was involved in, like when he initially took over the 94 boat, he had claimed a couple of, in his website, he had claimed a couple of operations that were before it.
Yeah.
When Ted Peck was a captain, including the one that Ted Peck was wounded on, kind of claimed them as his own. And Ted Peck came forward and, you know, set the record straight on that one. And they had to remove those from the website.
Yeah.
And I understand that not long afterwards, Ted Peck had a inquiry from the IRS, which seems very interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what did he get a Silver Star for? What was the circumstances for that?
Well, in that one, we picked up troops at Kainuk, and we were going to sweep a stream off the Bihop. And we get into that stream, and we were ambushed with small arms fire. And we offloaded the troops. We fired on... First time I saw a VC running, you know. Fired some shots. I actually got him into the correct side of the river that day.
Well, you're more experienced.
Yeah. I had been in a few firefights already. And we offloaded the troops and a couple of our Army advisors, U.S. Army advisors. And they swept down the 94 boat and the 23 boat, continued on the river. The 43 boat stayed there to support the troops that had been put ashore. We got up a little farther, and all of a sudden that B-40 went off right at the edge of right at the waterline. Didn't really do damage to the boat.
Yeah.
But sprayed some shrapnel. But I guess the guys had, the boat captains discussed this the night before, but they quickly turned and wheeled in and put the nose of the boats in the riverbank. Attacked the position, you know, went right into it. At that point, the guy jumped up out of the spider hole with the B-40 rocket launcher. He had loaded another RPG. But we spooked him, I guess, because we beached right in front of him. And he was about maybe 20 yards in. He popped up and ran. And the M60 claimed they nicked him in the leg or something. But afterwards, I didn't see any evidence of a leg wound. But Kerry jumped off the boat, and he and his leading PO, LPO, petty officer, jumped off with him with the M60. And the guy took off towards a little hooch, and then he must have been turning again to fire, but Kerry shot him. And after the sweep, I stayed aboard the boat. I was the assistant. I was considered, I guess, the assistant officer in charge. So I was going to direct any gunfire support needed for the sweep with the mortar. The 50 caliber machine gun, when we beached, had some stops in it, so you couldn't shoot the bow off the boat. He was elevated, couldn't get the gun down, so he couldn't shoot at that guy. So the 50s never were aimed at this guy when he popped out of the spider hole. So they swept the area. They found a VC resupply area. They were setting up a base camp, probably going to involve NVA. And they found hospital materials, sewing machines to make uniforms, to make flags, you know, all the supplies were there for a base camp that they were setting up. And so that all that stuff was destroyed or captured. When the sweep was concluded, we were backing off the bank, took fire from the other shore, the other river, side of the river bank. Some troops coming up from the other side. They weren't close, but they were firing at us. We suppressed that fire, took the troops back to Kainuk. And then when we exited the river at night, it was dark by then. Came up, we got ambushed again from a VC cemetery, which was along the bank of the river. It was on the south bank of the river. It was a night firefight. Our red tracers, every fifth round in the 50s is a tracer, a red. Their green tracers, our point detonated ammunition in the 50s, which every other, you know, every couple of rounds is a point detonated thing. That when it hit the trees, you'd see bright flashes. It was the most spectacular firefight I ever saw. It was like the 4th of July.
Wow, very colorful.
Our reds, their green tracers coming in, point detonated stuff, spectacular. It wasn't fun, but it was spectacular. And so that time we had three engagements that day. He, as far as I was concerned, he got the Silver Star for leading the operation very successfully. They had about 10 VC killed. He jumped off the boat and took out a guy that after I, that was the first casualty I had seen. When I got off the boat afterwards,
yeah.
Post sweep, looked around, the guy, he was shirtless, and he had on, I thought he had a shorts on, but he might not have, but I noticed the flies were already on the exit wound, but he had, the entry wound was this side, exit wound, which you can pick out easily because it's big from an M16, the flies were already congregating on it. I didn't see a leg wound.
Yeah.
But he didn't shoot this guy in the back.
Right.
He got him in the side. My, the way I envision it was the guy was turning
to fire.
Fire again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it wasn't a kid. It was, you know, probably late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
Much like our younger crewmen.
Yeah.
So it wasn't where O'Neill said he shot a kid in the back.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. And a wounded, helpless individual? Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
A guy with a loaded RPG.
So
we captured that. He captured it and brought it back. And that was the fourth day in the rivers. Fourth or fifth? That was the 28th. So that was fourth day. We patrolled the next 2 days, had more contact with the enemy, and then came back on the second or third. I think we got back after the patrol on the second. We probably headed back to Antoy. So,
well, so as far as you could see, he conducted himself.
Yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I will go to the other. My friend, who was typical Midwesterner, you know, just totally trustworthy, his version of the March 17th incident that Kerry got a Bronze Star for is entirely different than Kerry's version. So, and the guys, the other officers that were in on that, I know them well, and I trust them too.
Right. Know,
so,
yeah.
I think what happened is, if you're going to run for office, you got to live through it, you know. So I think he started thinking maybe a little bit about his own mortality and got concerned with survival.
Yeah.
Like we all did.
Right.
Yeah. Survival's at the top of your mind.
Right. Well, that certainly makes good sense. You mentioned that you worked with South Vietnamese troops on one or two occasions.
Yeah. Many occasions.
Yeah. What was your impression of them overall?
Well, the Rough Puffs, the RF, Regional Force, Popular Force.
Yeah.
I'd say, you know, that was their National Guard type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I had an incident, a very successful operation that I was OTC on in May, May 25th. If you go to that PCF45.com site,
yeah,
look up... And on the links,
yeah,
he has one up there at the top. He's got a bunch of links. is one, the Songendock, S-O-N-G, means river.
Yep.
The Ondock, O-N-D-O-C.
Okay.
If you click on that, you'll have the entire operation. A fellow named Steve Waterman was with the UDT team aboard. Good written, very well written. What happened was we were going into the Yumen Forest. We were going to go about 7 miles up the stream and do a sweep. We picked up the Rough Puff troops from the village of Sonnendock with an Army advisor who's from Florida, Army captain. And we headed up the Sonnendock, which is the southern border of the Yumen Forest. We were ambushed part way up. We had 5 boats. And mine went off in the water. And then we took small arms fire, B-40 round. Didn't hit anything. And we beached the boats on the ambush side. The way we were split, we had 3 boats that had gone through the ambush, 2 boats that hadn't. So we had 2 boats below it, 3 above it, UDT aboard, and Rough Puffs. The Rough Puffs were a little reluctant to get off the boat. The UDT, thank God we had the UDT team, they're always aggressive. They were just great guys to have aboard because you knew you could do well with them.
Yeah.
Now they were in the game. They were tough guys. So the UDT team is getting off the boats to go in and counterattack. We sprayed the place up with 50 caliber and everything else we had, threw a bunch of fire into them. I called in the helicopters because I didn't want an escape route north.
Yeah.
I wanted them to close the back door. So we had a nice pincer movement there. We had an opportunity to put an ambush out of business. And the Rough Puffs didn't want to get off the boat. UDT is already working their way in. And one of the UDT's officer told his Army counterpart to get him off the boat so he'd shoot him.
Interesting.
And they understood that.
Yeah.
So they got off the boats. The helicopters arrived. I watched a B-40 fired at the helicopters. They were so low. They were over the ambush crew. UDT was already knocked off a few of them. And so we had to be careful about how we fired in there. So the boats didn't fire. The helicopters could see what was going on. They knew where to fire. They knew where our guys were. And all of a sudden, the Rough Puffs got a big rah-rah in them, and they went in, you know, after most of the shooting had stopped.
They got inspired.
Yeah. It was extremely successful. We wiped out the entire ambush crew, a dozen of them, all dead. We didn't take a casualty except my forward M60 machine gunner in the bow. He caught a ricochet off of the tripod and barrel of his gun that went into his forearm. He actually had a piece of a round in his forearm. Hmm. That was the only casualty. We got a little fire from the other side and suppressed that as we were leaving. But it was the first time that a total ambush site had been wiped out successfully and all the weapons captured. And we went back to Sonnendock after that.
And you were in command that day?
Yeah.
So, and as far as the
V... It's called, the article is Ambush on the Sonnendock.
Ambush on the... Okay, I'll look that up.
And you can get it off this site.
Yep. So, the quality of the Vietnamese troops varied depending on which Vietnamese troops you served with. For the most part.
Yeah.
Did you ever learn to speak Vietnamese yourself?
No. Okay. We had Vietnamese language training, but like anything, if you don't use it, you're not going to retain it.
Right.
And I wasn't fluent in it to begin with. You know,
right.
It's not an easy language to learn.
No.
Neither is English.
No, no.
And we had the benefit of growing up with it.
And I mean, as you've indicated throughout this,
they would do some looting and stuff.
Yeah,
things like that. They'd be trying to bring sewing machines back to the boat. No, no.
Yeah, you don't need to wait on the boat with sewing machines, right? And as you pointed out earlier, you spent most of your time on a boat. You weren't mixing with the population at large, so there really wasn't an opportunity to practice foreign language speaking.
No.
Yeah. As your term of service approached the end, did you ever consider doing another tour, or were you just happy to leave?
I had talked to Don Droz about extending for ROTC or something.
Yeah.
I did not intend to make the Navy a career.
Yeah.
And by the time I was ready to come home, I was getting married in May. I got out of the country in late January. I had no intention of staying in. I never had an inclination to stay in, do another tour in Vietnam.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it was, in your opinion, do you feel it was detrimental rotating people out as quickly as they did, the lack of long-term experience on the boats?
I think it probably was. Yeah. As far as you mean, doing the half term on the boats and half term in a staff position or a training position, it probably was, but it was so intense in that half year tour on the boats that, I think, it really was if you were going to do a year in it, I don't know how your mental capacity was going to be.
So there was a good argument for it as well.
There was a good argument for it as well, but they're right. Because as I was getting experience as OTC and getting better at it, I knew my way in every river. I knew where every bump was, how to avoid the fishing weirs, which ones were new and might have mines on them.
Yeah.
Knowledge like that is something that you don't write down. You just know.
Right.
And that I think taking that out of the rivers, probably not a great idea. Yeah. But for the survival and for the morale, rotating, knowing you had a chance to get out.
Yeah.
Rather than a 75% chance of going a year and getting creamed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was good.
Okay.
So there's both sides of that argument.
Sure. Did you, when I wrote these questions, of course, I hadn't talked to you. So, more things come to mind as we go forward. It seems to me you were, as we pointed out earlier, you're incredibly lucky in many ways with your experiences.
I had a great crew.
Yeah.
And that's luck of the draw because they were assigned. We didn't know each other before we got to Swift School.
Yeah.
They were good guys.
Yeah.
They were all good guys.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys really, they weren't trained for this.
Right.
They didn't expect this.
Right.
But they did their job.
Right.
John Wayne never served, but he had the best description of courage I ever heard. It's being scared to death and saddling up anyway.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Because fear, I don't know how it is with other guys. Fear is what drove my adrenaline. And it was more the fear of being looked upon by your crew as a coward is not as great, is much greater than the fear of being wounded or killed. And also, if your crew loses confidence in you, they're going to be a step slower, worried about themselves. You're not doing anybody a favor. So, you just scared to death and saddle up anyway.
Did you have any kind of sense that did you have any sense of that you were going to have such a positive outcome, or did you ever consider that you weren't going to make it, or did you think about these things?
The first week in the rivers, in 10 firefights, I said to one of my guys, I says, at this rate, I don't know if we're going to get through this.
Yeah.
So it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
There were some respites in there that were unexpected, like when the boat had the engine out. We had more days off than normal.
Right.
And then we were hot bunking boats and using other guys' boats
right.
to keep them going. But no, there were nice little breaks in there that, thank you very much. None of them intentional. But
your experiences, and I guess the experiences of your compatriots on the Swift boats were very different from a lot of other people's experiences because you worked with small groups of people relatively isolated for long periods of time. So you really did have to count on those other people.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Absolutely.
Right.
Everybody counted on each other.
Right.
And if somebody was a little bit wacky about wanting, you know, expressing interest in getting a Purple Heart or something, I didn't want them.
Right.
On my ops, because if they don't respect their life, they certainly don't respect my crews and mine.
Right.
So, you know, well,
that makes sense.
You guys admitted they were scared. You're welcome on my boat.
Right.
You're welcome in my, you know, operation.
You want someone who's rational, obviously. Yeah.
I want somebody that respects life enough to want to survive.
So I've asked you this question a couple of times, so I just to revisit it one more time. At the end of your service, did you have any great epiphanies about the war itself, or did you not really think about any of that, basically? You thought about going home, more or less.
You're still gung-ho at that point, because you've got friends still doing it.
Right, okay.
So, you know, you want them in surviving.
Right.
They were already turning over boats to the Vietnamese when we got out of... We still had our base.
Yeah.
But they were turning boats over in Saigon from some of the other bases and stuff. So eventually, our base was going to be turned over, and you'd have some Navy in there as advisory status. Yeah. But that's so while our guys were in there, you really
you're
wanted
still
to,
pretty gung ho.
Yeah, you were.
So you've alluded to this to some degree in the past, but rolling back to John Kerry and the anti-war movement and what have you. So after his service, Kerry joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He testified before Congress about atrocities and various different things. And I'm sure you were aware of it probably at the time. What was your reaction?
My reaction was very negative. I felt that he was betraying us. He was especially betraying the guys that were still over there. He was pretty much saying we were all Genghis Khan, which is not true. The Winter Soldier bit and stuff, he had guys testifying to atrocities that were later found to have not have ever served. Or some of the ones that claimed to have served in Vietnam may have been in the service, but not in Vietnam. I mean, the whole thing really ticked me off. And one of the ones that I was especially... he spoke at Smith College one time. I was going to go up and ask a question from the audience. I didn't do it, but he was... He talked a lot about the free fire zone concept and stuff. Well, the free fire zone, use of the free fire zone was up to the officer in tactical command. It wasn't, you didn't have to go in firing your guns all the time. That was the OTC that made that decision. And every time I operated with him, he would fire up the riverbanks wherever, trying to trigger an ambush. And that was his decision.
So he was the aggressive one.
Yeah, I wanted to confront him about that question.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was your decision. Why'd you make it?
Right.
You know, my feeling in most cases, not all cases, because we did where we knew ambushes might occur, we did light it up a little bit because we knew there weren't civilians around.
Right.
But I always like to possibly hear. If we were going to get fired on, I wanted to at least hear where it was coming from, or see the puff of smoke or whatever, or the muzzle flashes before I fired, because I just wanted to know where it was coming from first.
Right.
No benevolence there.
Right.
It was just a difference of opinion.
Yeah.
It was tough to hear anything. If you probably wouldn't hear a sniper fire because of the boats were noisy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was just a personal decision.
Right. He wanted a why waste ammo, right?
Yeah.
So, a lot of Vietnam veterans, when they got back from the war, experienced being, or at least spoke about being shunned and, you know, treated badly by the public. Did you have any of that experience yourself?
No, personally? I was lucky. I had the greatest rehab program ever invented. When I got back, and Brenda was in L.A. at the time. She was flying out of L.A. as a flight attendant. She lived in Manhattan Beach with three other flight attendants. And she was going to transfer back to Boston when I got out of the service. So I got out, mustered out in Long Beach. So I came back to L.A. Wonderful flight into McCord, Travis Air Force Base, north of San Francisco. First time I saw any of the Hare Krishna stuff that was going on at San Francisco Airport.
Yeah.
And, you know, you heard of the incidents. You're in uniform. Flew down to L.A. I didn't have any incidents at all. When I reported to the base, actually, Brenda's cousin was there to meet me, and I stayed with them the first night. Brenda was getting in that night from a trip, so I waited at the airport for her. And then I moved in on the living room couch with four flight attendants in Manhattan Beach, California, half a block from the beach.
Wow.
It was perfect. And I lived there for a month. And if Brenda was on a trip, a couple of the other girls would go to dinner. You know, everybody, I had a ball.
Ah.
I mustered out. I had piled $5,000 on a Brenda's bureau. We flew up to San Francisco and saw the city with her cousin. And, you know, her folks lived in San Diego at the time. We'd be down there. I had my brother, who's 13 years younger than me. He was in junior high. Had him and our cousin fly out because I needed an excuse to go to Disneyland.
Yeah, yeah.
Took them to Disneyland. Showed them, you know, took them down to San Diego and all over the place. We had a ball. We had a wonderful time. So I was there for a month. The kids were there. I had my brother and cousin there for about 6 days. It was school vacation.
Were you still in the service officially at that point?
Yeah. Yeah.
How much longer were you in the service?
I got out of Vietnam on, I think, the 20th of January. And I mustered out. They had to give me leave time, travel time,
yeah,
to the East Coast. So I was officially out February 10th.
Ah.
So we got to see a lot. When we went up to San Francisco, one of the only two incidents that I had any flashback or any recurrence was we were up in San Francisco in late January, early February or something around Chinatown. And somebody let off a string of firecrackers.
Oh.
For a moment, I almost ducked under a car. But
wow.
Just for a moment.
Yeah.
The only other incident I had was a few years later, up here, going up Route 57 in Agawam. There's a Mill Street exit there.
Yeah.
It goes up by Agawam High School.
Yeah, 75, yeah.
So state trooper there with a radar gun. And I come up over the overpass over Suffield Street.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there's a guy standing there like this. And I, just for a moment.
Right.
And that's the only time I ever had any type of a reaction that was caused by that.
Did you get a ticket?
No. I wasn't speeding. I was just, what?
How long after that did you and Brenda get married?
We got married, we came back to Boston, I would say late February. We got married in May, on the 23rd of May. I was invited to John Kerry's wedding, 23rd of May in New York City, but I was getting married in Philadelphia, so I didn't go.
Wow.
Same day.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Before the election, were you in touch with him at all over the years?
The only time I had contacted him was when he was lieutenant governor. I was working at UMass.
Yeah.
And had a fellow who was a state purchasing agent, good guy, who was a real business type. You know, he wasn't the guy that predated him was the governor's driver.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Al Holland. Nice guy. But, yeah. You know, backslapper. But, and I put in a word for John Manton to keep him going as the state purchasing agent, not to replace him.
Yeah.
So I contacted him then. I wrote the op-ed when he was running for president. I was not a John Kerry supporter. I couldn't get in. I didn't want to get into the anti-Kerry stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm a middle of the road.
Right.
Politically, we're not in tune.
Yeah.
But I'm not a strict conservative either.
Right.
And I felt he may not have served a long time, but I knew he had been in 10 firefights plus some. So right. I knew he had been involved. You know, he earned his right to speak. An interesting aside on that is we were down in Raleigh, North Carolina. Brenda's brother had lung cancer, he was in the fifth stage, and he got into an experimental program. He was in the pharmaceutical industry with a guy that used to work for him in his Exxon chemical career. Brenda's brother spent most of his business life with Exxon. He spent it in South America or in Aruba or, you know.
Yeah.
And he liked the warm weather. So when he retired from Exxon, a guy that used to work for him was very successful, a guy from Italy in the pharmaceutical business. He was buying manufacturing facilities and, you know, making them work better, and, you know. And so he went to work with him, but he developed lung cancer somewhere along the line. And the interesting thing was the program he went into was one that a fellow he worked with in the chemical industry in the town that they start the Boston Marathon in.
Yeah.
What the heck town is? You know where I mean.
I know where you mean exactly. It's been in the news constantly, but I can't remember the name of it either. Yeah,
you're not old enough to be that way.
Yeah, you're probably right. But
anyway,
soon.
They were running a trial, and he got into it at Duke Medical Center.
Okay.
Well, he was... the thing was caustic to him. The process was caustic. And his wife was up. They lived in Cartagena, Colombia. She's a Cartagena native.
Uh-huh.
And he met her when he was living in South America. So we went down. Brenda's mother and Brenda and I went down to help her because all of a sudden he's in intensive care and not doing well. So while we were down there, I didn't have C-SPAN up here at the time. I had cable, but I didn't have that. And I turn on the TV down there, and here's a bunch of guys I know. It's the press conference for the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. Their initial press conference.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a bunch of faces that I knew a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know? So I watched that, and I had a lot of friends involved. A lot of them had served with Kerry, that small group of about a dozen. A lot of them served with Kerry, but they had been painted with that wide brush of cutting off ears and heads and tying electrodes to the body parts. And you know, it was, they had had enough.
So
they had been called too many names to let this go.
So do you feel that whole, a lot of that process behind that Swift Boat Veterans Against for the Truth was revenge?
I don't think it was revenge. I think there was a lot of untruth being told.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, some of these episodes were taken over by, you know, what your mind can do.
Right.
You're doing similar things, but that one's noted, so right. That one's mine.
Right.
So there were a lot of inconsistencies. Those three that he took of Ted Peck's were right. One of them. The incident in March 17th with the boat being blown out of the water.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah.
They weren't the way it happened. Okay. You never saw, first of all, when you're in a firefight, you never see the big picture anyway. It's not like CinemaScope.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that one. Look at, you see little bits and pieces where your eyes are.
Right.
And afterwards, you can put the pieces together and get a scope of the entire
right.
Operation.
Right.
So some of the guys that were involved in the Swift Boat Veterans, one of them being my buddy who got blown out of the water, and two others, Jack Chenoweth, who was ops officer, who became ops officer just before I became the maintenance officer,
yeah.
And Larry Thurlow, a Kansas honest-to-God farmer,
yeah.
Great guy, you know, got together, and they're talking about that Bronze Star, and all of a sudden they realize it's the incident they were involved in, but they didn't realize it until they put the pieces together.
Right. Right.
And it just didn't jive.
Right.
So there were elements of truthfulness that they wanted the record set straight on. Some of them, and the ones I would say that didn't know Kerry and didn't serve with him, wanted to answer the fact that they... I had one guy, one good friend, who's... He had a second, younger family.
Yeah.
You know, this little kid who's now, I think, going to be a junior in college, asked him if he had killed babies after hearing all this
yeah.
stuff. Can you imagine
yeah.
your son asking you that?
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I can understand it.
So they were painted with a broad brush,
right.
And everybody thought that we were a bunch of animals,
right.
And we weren't.
Right.
You can become an animal.
Right.
It's real easy to shoot at somebody that's shooting at you.
Right.
But we didn't shoot at people that weren't shooting at us. So.
Yeah. So I mean, it sounds like you very realistically can see both sides of some of the allegations that were made in there.
I also had a brother who was mayor of a local small city who had, when Kerry visited his office after he was elected,
yeah.
had my scrapbook pictures
yeah.
on his desk. And Kerry all of a sudden knew that Eddie's brother was a Swiftie who served with him. So... he had a good connection politically for the town
yeah.
that I wasn't going to screw up for him.
Right.
Because I didn't want any revenge
right.
on a town that didn't.
Right.
Didn't
did you vote for him? In 04?
Actually, I didn't. I didn't. I supported his service.
Yeah.
But... I thought about that a long time, and I didn't vote for him.
Okay. One more question before I ask. I want to thank you because it was really an extraordinary interview, far more than I ever expected to get as far as information. I think for most people, as I said in the beginning, they have no idea what really went on with this.
I don't know if I do. I mean, we're sitting here, and it was 44 years ago.
Right.
Right now.
Right. No, you seem to have brought it to life.
44 years.
You seem to have brought it to life. I think, you know, again, what's most unfortunate is that the information that people do have about the Swift Boats have to do with the presidential campaign, which really is beside the point, you know? So this is really good to actually learn what people went through.
I was... I liked it when nobody knew what a Swift Boat was.
Yeah.
That was better. That was my comfort zone.
Yeah.
I did not like being contacted by reporters from the Globe and reporters from here and reporters from there. That was not my thing. One thing I'd mention, that for my time of service and the time we were there, on January 22nd of 1969, all the officers in Kozdiv 11, except for four that had to, they had to maintain something down there, were brought up to Saigon for a briefing with General Abrams and Admiral Zumal. And the briefing was, we were going to be stepping up operations in the rivers because the peace talks in Paris, one of the arguments they had was that Kissinger was not, could not be speaking for Vietnam because the North Vietnamese controlled the Four Corps, the Kamau Peninsula, Yu Minh Forest.
Yep.
So that meeting was to let it, to notify everybody that we were going to be stepping up the riverine operations. They came up with the Sea Lords Raiders, which were what we dealt with. And I got in country 3 weeks after that. I won another lottery.
Wow.
But what are the odds? Think they'll send me to Antoine? Yes.
Wow. So that's an interesting point.
Yeah, it was. It was, here we go. You know, it was...
So 44 years, that's almost a half a century.
Yes,
since all this happened. How do you feel about the war today? Is there anything, in your opinion, the country can learn from that experience?
We can learn things from every war we've been in, but we don't. We never learn from our experience, especially the bits about the country itself. Culturally, things like that. We're isolated. United States of America, we have a border to the north of people that look like us and speak like us. And to the south, we have a border with Mexico. We don't have the interaction that, you know, we know the Middle East on a map.
Right.
We don't culturally. And we have somebody advising us that would like to go back to their country and be the president, you know. So obviously they have things that are in their best interests that aren't necessarily in ours. So I'll leave it to the historians. And they'll argue it forever. Because I don't know if there are any answers. So, but yes, we should learn each.
That's very well put. Anything else you'd like to add? Anything that I overlooked that you think...
No,
posterity should know about?
I think it's nice that it's known that the Coast Guard played a big part on the rivers.
You know, good.
People don't know that, or they should.
Okay. They should. Good. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Charlie.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A little walk through history.